This is a Harper Guys production.
The following will contain adult subject matter and may not be suitable for all audiences.
How much can one family take?
Welcome to the gallows.
I'm Jake. With me as always, my co-host Adam. And go ahead.
Yo.
Welcome aboard. We're going to go ahead and get started with the abbreviated PSA. We guys know that you guys know where to find us at these days. And you've obviously found us here on the Patreon show tonight. So just give them the quick and dirty.
Well, that's pretty much it. I mean, they know what platforms to find us on. Anything, anywhere, any way.
Yeah, and we would appreciate it that we know that if you're watching right now, that you might not be on our YouTube channel. So if you get a chance, go subscribe to the YouTube channel.
Yeah, for the Harper Guys.
For the Harper. Yeah, that's our other Harper Guys production show.
Yes.
So definitely got to throw that out there.
And do a search with the Harper Guys, because the Harper is not cooperating, unless it's been updated.
Okay.
But
good to know going in.
Yeah, the Harper Guys.
Harper Guys, you'll find us right away.
Right, this is episode
28,
maybe 28.
I think it's 28 tonight, right?
I think so.
So, little bit going on in the world of executions. We did have the third execution by the federal government. It went as planned on 7/17. It did actually get to stay for a minute, but ultimately, by the end of the day, they had gotten it done. So, Dustin Lee Honkin has been executed by the state. So the upcoming that we had in Harold Wayne Nichols in Tennessee, they, because of the uptick in the coronavirus, have actually stayed all executions temporarily. At this point, I'm not really mad at states that are doing that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, anything to avoid a crowd, right?
Right.
So, but still on the docket as of right now is we have Keith Wayne Dawson. He will be the fourth and last for a while for the federal executions. And then John Ramirez on 9/9 in Texas.
Okay.
So we still got some coming up through the end of the year. We'll be interested to see how COVID and other things, how it works out. It's been kind of a strange year in every way. And this would definitely be just another category to add to that pile.
Yes. Yes, it would.
Absolutely.
I don't know. COVID's going to be shutting down a bunch of stuff here shortly. So.
But it's not shutting us down, so we're good to go.
We are going full bore.
Absolutely. So tonight's story begins on October the 18th, 1985. Middle school math teacher Rick Patterson decided to go to the grocery store to get his shopping done, right? So shopping is something that Rick would actually typically do during the week, because as a school teacher, he was busy Monday through Friday, you know, to where he's like, my day's already wasted, might as well do it. And he liked to kind of keep a weekend, to where I thought that was an interesting way of looking at your schedule, because a lot of us do that kind of stuff on the weekends.
Sure.
You know? So he went in, he got all the stuff that he needed to get, and he gets back out to his car, and he opens the door, and as he opens the door, he gets pushed inside and pushed into the passenger seat. And the other guy hops in the back seat, and they head off going north out of Oklahoma City. So that's where we're starting off here, is Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. So there was actually a witness that saw the abduction take place, saw the whole thing.
Really?
Yeah. And so she went in and she had him call the police, and several people that were in the store then were able to say, hey, you know, we saw these people too. So they basically got together and did a sketch, and the people were like, yeah, these are spot on. Like, These are fantastic. Like, this is exactly who you guys are looking for. So the car gets to the point where it's heading west, and they decide that they're going to stop because they had forced him out, and they make him get out of the car, and they end up taping up his hands and putting him in the trunk, to where it's never a good omen to be heading for the trunk.
No.
You know?
That's a bad place.
Right. So they proceed on Interstate 40, heading like west-northwest at this point, and there's a wooded area that's up there a couple miles from what would be the Rockwell Avenue exit, if you guys are familiar with the area. And they told Rick to get out of the car, and when they popped the trunk and told him that, they could see that he had actually got himself free, and like he was like trying to come out and make a move on him, which I think that that's super commendable in a situation like that.
Sure.
So they end up grabbing him together, and he actually had some rope in his own trunk that they used then to tie his hands behind his back. So they told him, hey, you know, stand right here, and they like leaned him against a tree, and apparently they talked for a few minutes, you know, on exactly what they were going to do, and then just all of a sudden, shot rings out. He actually gets struck right in the back of the head with a 12 gauge, and he goes down, and it's a tough scene. On it, I mean, honestly, he's clinging to his life at this point, and another person approaches and finishes him off with a second shot. So he was killed instantly with the second shot. So that brings us through the weekend. His family starts to get worried. You know, nobody's heard from him, you know, to where they start putting contacts out. They start looking for his car to see if anybody can track him down. On Monday morning, the 21st, so it's been over the weekend into Monday, there were two guys that were actually out hunting deer in that wooded area. It was actually a public wooded area. And they noticed that there was a group of buzzards that had been circling around. And a lot of times, if you have a deer that is wounded and goes down, like, you'll see the buzzards start circling. It's actually a way to find one if you're actually hunting and trying to recover one. Absolutely. So as they get to the area, they start looking around, and within about 10 minutes in a little brush area, they found Rick's body. His car wasn't anywhere to be found by him. And honestly, it was a situation where they had so little to go on at this point. I mean, there's no shell casings that are left. The only tire prints are Rick's car. There's a couple kind of vague footprints that can be made out, but there's nothing that's really left in the middle of the night, you know, other than tracks coming in and tracks coming out. So it kind of makes it for a tough situation.
Sure. Absolutely.
So obviously they have to notify the family, you know, and the family was just shocked. I mean, they talked about how he didn't have any enemies. He was one of those people that, like, who would envision ever trying to hurt this guy, right? Well, the car becomes the linchpin that they're looking for, and they can't find it after searches throughout the state. You know, they put the APB out, the whole nine yards. So the family gets frustrated as the case goes cold very quickly. I mean, by Christmas time, there was nothing else going on, right? I mean, no time at all. And so they hire a private investigator. They think, you know, maybe this is going to be the guy that's going to lead us to the promised land.
Sure.
And he comes in and he finds nothing. So, I mean, the whole thing is just completely dead, you know? I mean, no pun intended, but there's no evidence in the case to point towards anything. So that was in late 1985. So this brings us into 1986 in August. And there's a little town called Del Rey that is about 15 miles due east of Oklahoma City. So it's kind of like a little suburb out there, you know. And on that date, that's when they had two guys got arrested out there, right? There was a series of robberies that had gone on. They got a couple phone calls. They knew who these guys were. And they actually picked them up at a guy named Perry Scott King's house, right? He answers the door and they said, hey, we're looking for a couple guys. And they instantly try to flee out the back door, but they got cops actually that are out there stage looking for them. So these two guys are Scott Thornton and Robert Burgett. And they're taken into custody immediately on a whole lineage of charges, right? Well, Thornton immediately lawyers up. And Burgett says, I have a question for you. He said, would you trade all the crimes that you have me for on this right now if I gave you a big one? And he asked the sheriffs if they'd heard about the teacher that had been murdered. Well, it actually took like all of 2 seconds for one of the deputies to recognize Burgett as one of the men in the sketches, because he had actually been down as a sheriff. He had actually been at one of the other precincts where they had it up, which I thought that was kind of crazy, you know, that somebody recognized them actually from the sketch. Because I feel like some of the time sketches are kind of like off, you know what I mean?
Sure.
So they were like, well, what do you have to say? And he goes, well, I'm willing to give up the actual person that did this in exchange for a light sentence. But he said, the only way that I'm going to tell you this story is if you have him picked up and in custody, then I'll talk, but not till then. So instantly, like, they know that they have a serious problem, like that he's clearly afraid of what of who this other guy is, right? So Michael Patrick Smith was a super well-known felon, even at the age of 21, in Oklahoma City. He had been involved with drugs, theft, assaults, all before he was 21. And then he ended up spending two, like, of his first three adult years locked up as well for various crimes, right? So it was kind of strange that he was known around the area as, like, the tough guy. You know, like, he's gonna throw down if he has to, you know what I mean? And just basically intimidation, fear, that kind of stuff, you know?
Right.
And, you know, Burgett said openly, like, hey, I'm afraid of this guy. And I'm afraid, like, what he's going to end up doing to my family. So they actually end up arresting both of them on that day. It's actually August the 14th of 86, right? And they said, hey, you know, we got 24 hours to bring the charges up, you know? And so Burgess like, okay. And he just tells them the story immediately about how they got him out there, says that Smith did all the shooting, that it was obviously Smith's idea to steal the car, right? So immediately they bring both of them up on first-degree murder charges. Well, what's weird to me is they actually put them in the same jail, like in the same like jail block, to where instead of getting them way far apart from each other, which is what you would think you would do, even a common building, they were literally like had access to each other.
Yeah. Plus the first guy's plan backfired there.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm saying.
He wanted like, a light sentence and here he got murder charge.
Right. And he's shacked up and he's got the guy that's on the other side of him, like literally sharing the same area with him. I mean, that's not very good protection for somebody that's trying to help you out here, right?
I don't think they cared.
I mean, clearly they didn't. So
somebody in there didn't like him.
I would say not at all. So what happens next isn't exactly clear, but they end up having a true face-to-face encounter, like right in the middle of the hall there. So they talk about it, and like from what the guards have reported and what other prisoners say, they're not exactly sure, but what they know is that there is definitely a conversation that lasts at least 20 seconds, maybe up to a minute, and that there actually might have been some kind of a beating that was handed out, but they don't know the extent of everything. Apparently, they didn't have the cameras rolling at that point in time. I mean, 86, you think probably not having them all in all the precincts?
That's a tall coin flip.
Yeah. I mean, they had closed circuit back then, though, right? Yeah, to where you could watch CCTV?
I think.
Yeah. No, either way, they didn't get any of it. So on September 28th then, which is just a couple weeks after this happened, he goes to his lawyer and he says, look, I want to plead guilty to the shooting and that Smith was not involved in anything. And he's like, wait, what? He's like, yep. He's like, that's what I want. So he is able to plead guilty and he actually, at Smith's trial, he actually changes his story again and he actually said that Smith wasn't even there. That he helped him with the abduction and they dropped him off and he was never there, right? So with the admission of guilt, you know, and even though he tried to help them out on it initially and then he flipped his story because they weren't able to use his story, the judge throws the book at him and gives him the death sentence for it.
Whoa!
Yeah, to where it's a very, we'll get back into more of that later, but shocked. Just that, like, that's what earned it for him, right? Well,
they hated this guy.
They didn't like him, right? Well, he was shocked to say the least. And so then he tries to rescind what his actual plea was. Well, he finds out that the judge that has to approve him changing his plea is the same judge that just gave him a death sentence. So what do you think happened?
Of course.
Nothing. So that's it. I mean, over the next 13 years, he's in prison and he starts claiming his innocence. He said that Smith had threatened that his friends would actually do harm to his family outside the prison, you know, and now he's like off drugs and everything. And he realizes like that was the wrong way to go. Well, he's got another problem though, to where at this point to me, a lot of it sounds like maybe he didn't do it. Maybe he was involved in a bad situation. You know what I mean? But maybe he didn't do it. I don't really know.
Right.
Right. Well, so they get to talking and he's like, well, what if I can help you with something else, you know, to maybe get my sentence commuted, you know? And they're like, well, what do you got? He said that, in 1986, a couple weeks before they actually arrested him, that, him and Porter King, who he had actually been staying with, which makes me surprised that he opened the door, given this case, that this guy was actually having an affair with the wife of a man named Jim Meadows, right? And Jim was a compulsive drinker and her name was LaDonna. And she basically would have her affair with King and say, oh, he's beating me up, and oh, he's going to do this, and oh, he's going to do that. So the two of them got together, and they killed him. And there's not, I mean, there is not hardly any information that you can find about this. All it says is that he said that they took care of him. Basically, they got King into custody. They knew that he had rolled over on the whole thing, and he ended up taking a deal to 25 years, like, immediately. So none of this stuff ever came out. There was hardly any pretrial stuff or anything to where the exact details of what happened to that poor guy, we don't actually know, right? So King pleads to the 25 years to life, right? And it was the same judge that had actually been dealing with Burkett, right? So, which is kind of weird that the same judge is handling all these cases as well, right?
Very weird.
Right. So this brings us back to Smith. And he had a death sentence, and he had it commuted, right? They found a bunch of technicalities in the first one. So this is Smith. So this is the bad guy that, you know, that he's saying actually did all this, right? He had it commuted to life. So while he's in prison for life at this point, this is the 21-year-old turned bad guy. He kills two more of his cellmates, kills a guard, and now after all of this, he is serving six life sentences plus 500 years. They still won't give him the death penalty. It makes no sense. And it's the
Jesus, what do you have to do to get the death penalty?
I mean, right, but like they just handed it out to the other guy.
What state are we in?
This is Oklahoma.
Oklahoma.
So they just handed it out to the other guy on like shoddy, I mean, even life sentence, that's shoddy information. Wait, you know what I mean?
Isn't Oklahoma where they don't do the death penalty? They just give it out?
No, they used to. No, that's Kansas that you're thinking of.
Oh,
from
Kansas.
The last show,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So this ends up being six life sentences plus 500 years is the second longest prison sentence ever given out in the United States. Like somebody got more than 500 years. But that's crazy.
Jesus.
Well, throughout all of this, he actually escaped three times. He attempted at least a dozen more escapes, which none of those were obviously successful.
Well, you got 500 years. I mean, you got time to think.
And he assaulted, and to date, he's assaulted so many officers that what they ended up doing was building a special cage for him that he's basically in, special cell. Shouldn't call it a cage, but to see this thing, it looks like something out of a movie. Basically, it's like a long, narrow corridor, and there's a thing that pushes forward so that he has to come walking out of a direct into a direct little square area. And they use five armored SWAT team members, like prison riot gear, like to bring this guy out.
So this one guy is causing, and I will say wasting so much money.
Right. So, but what
taxpayers' money.
Right, but this is the guy clear at the beginning that was part of the very beginning of the story that helped Breggett steal a car. And Breggett said, hey, he's the one that actually killed him. I'm afraid for my life and for my family. They give this guy a death sentence. This guy's the worst prisoner we've had on here in quite a while, and this is what he gets for it.
I mean, they won't kill him.
Right. They won't give it to him. It's insane. Even with Rodney and Bars for the murders and, you know, swearing that he didn't commit them, you know, time eventually ran out for Burkett. And he was scheduled to die via lethal execution in 2002. And this definitely brought some measure of peace to the Peterson and Meadows families. But both groups actually expressed that they thought that the real killers were both still in jail. And they didn't really believe that he had committed either one of the murders. To where he had said in one of the few things that he had said to anybody in his family towards the end that meant a lot to him. That at least those people believed that he didn't kill their children. Right? So ironically, at the same time, though, he's got a little brother named Rodney that is doing a 3-year stretch for stealing a car, of all things. And he's actually in a penitentiary when his brother's execution happens. So when Roger gets executed, he's got a brother in prison that actually didn't get to be there for him for any of it at the end, which that would be tough, you know. And he actually would go on to say that he wept in prison. You know, he said he knew that it made him weak, but he didn't care. But the two brothers, Roger and Rodney, had actually grown up really, really close. And this really tore Rodney up to have Roger gone. So Roger was actually born in 1960, and Rodney was born in 1962, right? Well, they were the fifth and sixth children of this family that was already struggling. They had a farm, and it was failing, right? Their mom ended up in a situation where she was having affairs. The father would be gone for long, 2, 3, 4 days at a time. You know, when he was home, he drank. It's just a terrible upbringing for these kids, you know, a lot of abuse, stuff that had going on. Well, finally, the family splits in 1970. So these boys are 8 and 10 at the time, right? So once the home gets broken, they actually get worse. I mean, now they're kind of free to roam. Like, nobody's even trying to watch them together, right? So they end up getting into drugs, fights, and they were kind of the bad kids, but there were people that realized, you know, these kids just aren't getting a shot. I mean, they had principals and different people say, you know, these kids are just behind the A-ball, you know? Like, it's kind of crazy. And the other thing that I think is really kind of terrible about this is the four siblings that were older, they were all at least 4 years older. So within a couple of years, the youngest one would have been able to jump in. Like, how do you, none of your siblings, make sure that the two younger ones are all right? Hmm. You know what I mean? I'm not throwing blame on anybody else in the family. I'm just asking, like, from a family unit, like, how do you not get them out of the situation into something better?
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? Well, finally in 1980, the two get split up. From all the running around and the crazy stuff that they did, Roger begins his first actual prison sentence, and that would be the last time that the two would ever get to see each other in person, because they would be overlapping between those times. So this brings us to 2002, and Rodney gets released. So 2 years after his brother's executed, Rodney gets released, and he goes to stay with one of his sisters. She actually throws him a 40th birthday party, you know, things are going well, and he actually meets a new woman in town a couple weeks later, to where they start dating, and her name was Tammy. And she was really into Rodney, but she told him, like, look, you are just so jacked up emotionally, like, I can't do this. Like, you're just not going to work for me in this situation. And just basically broke the entire thing off, you know? Well, this just kind of turned him into a wreck, you know, that something was wrong with him, that he wasn't footing the bill, you know what I mean? To where he felt like he had been emotionally there, and he wasn't. So on June the 1st of 2003, she actually breaks things off with him. Well, this sends Rodney into a complete tailspin. He actually heads to her apartment that's in Lead, South Dakota, and finds her in bed with another man, pulls out a revolver, shoots them both in the head, gets back into his car, and heads for Sturgis because he needs to get some gas, and he's trying to get away at this point. So he goes to the convenience store, and there's this 20-year-old girl that's working there, and he just decides, you know what? I'm still a man. I can do whatever I want to. So he kidnaps this girl, takes her back to a hotel that's actually just outside of Deadwood, and he sexually assaults her. Now, they don't say rape, anything I can find, and it actually sounds like there were some issues for him along the way to where it didn't quite progress to that point, but either way, after about 45 minutes of her being there, he actually was like, just go, just get the fuck out of here. So he lets this girl go, which I was shocked by that, given this entire situation. Well, within 10 minutes, this place is swarming with cops. So now we got a standoff situation. So this goes on for a couple of hours back and forth. You know, he actually ends up giving himself up, right? So less than a year after all this happens, they're on the night before of his trial. You know, he's going to go to trial for all this shit, you know, tried to kill two people. They both survived. Good news, right? To where both of the people they shot in the head, they both survived.
What?
Yeah. So he doesn't have any Murder One charges going against him.
How did they survive?
They both survived headshots from a revolver.
Jeez, he must have been horrible shot.
No, but he was shooting with intent to kill. And that kind of was a little bit of a big deal in this whole thing.
Yeah.
Right? So this is where things get like really crazy, that he's up for this. And the night before it's supposed to start, he pleads guilty to one of the attempted murders. Right? So what this means with the guilty plea is that he's automatically given a life sentence because of the other crimes that he admitted during that hearing that he had actually done, other felonies, right? So basically like three strikes and you're like all the way out, right? If he would have just gone through the trial, the way that the law works in Oklahoma, which I think this is strange, the most they could have given him was 25 years. How do you do that at that point? I have no idea how you voluntarily give yourself a life sentence instead of 25 years.
That's insane.
I mean, no sane person would do that, right? Well, his sanity is immediately questioned. I mean, at least somebody's like, maybe we should check this thing out, right? They actually sent him to an entire panel of specialists, and they all give him intelligence quotients, and they all come back between 82 and 96. So they're like, he's well above where we need him to be, you know, for anything to be considered cognitively off, you know? And now clearly, even if you're a little bit below average and you have a really, really tough upbringing, I mean, at some point, we've talked about how that's not a crutch, but it's definitely a contributing factor. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it's like to say that this guy's in his right mind when he makes that decision, I think is a little bit of a stretch, right? But he does it and they accept it. So this got him sent up to the state penitentiary in Sioux Falls. South Dakota. So he's actually in another state now. He's actually in South Dakota where all this has happened. Sorry, I missed that. The little nugget for you earlier, right? So he's a little further north.
I knew that when you said Deadwood.
Yeah, I figured that you did, but I wanted to, and just making sure that we get the right towns.
I was going to say, not yeah. all of our
Sturgis,
audience.
Sturgis, anybody that knows Sturgis.
Yeah,
you know?
Not everybody's been to Deadwood, South Dakota, but
right,
I have.
But yeah, it's a good time. So that begins in 2004. It's when he starts serving that sentence, right? So this takes us to 2011. 7 years, he's actually not being the worst version of himself, right? He's got all good behavior since he's been there, and he's 18 months away from getting moved to a medium security prison where he gets to serve out the rest of his life sentence, which I guess that's better. I mean, I don't know. But the thing that he was kind of looking forward to from the way that everything sounds is it would actually give him some more freedoms in the prison, you know, to be able to go to commissary and stuff like that in the middle of the day to where when you're in maximum security, things are locked down all the time.
Yeah.
So he kind of gets restless with his entire situation. And so he decides that, you know, with the help of another inmate, mind you, that it's time to try to get out of here. Right. And this guy's name is Eric Robert. So he's got two first names, which is always one of my favorites. Right. So he's already serving a life sentence for kidnapping. So these two come up with an idea of how they're going to escape out of prison. Right. So on the morning of August 12th, Ronald Johnson, he's working as a guard, and it's supposed to be his day off, but they had like a scheduling change, so he actually had to come in, and it was his 63rd birthday, right? So, but he said, you know, he looked at it as this was part of the job. You know, that's what people had said about him, like that he that loved this job his entire life. It was what it was. He'd get around to his birthday when he got home, you know? So at one point of the day, it's about 11 o'clock in the morning, 11:15 actually. Lunch starts at 11, so he goes around a corner because he's checking to make sure that there's no prisoners left in their cells. They all have to come down. It's not optional at this point, right? As he comes around the corner, he's actually struck with a 2-foot-long lead pipe and just beaten absolutely unconscious. And then they end up wrapping cellophane around his head. So I don't know if that was an effort to suffocate him.
I'm going to say, it's hard to breathe with that.
It is hard to breathe, especially if you're bleeding all over the place and you're unconscious, right? So Robert, at this point in time, he's one of the two guys, you know, that are in on the heist here. He goes ahead and strips off the guard's clothes and puts them on so that he looks like a guard. And then he hides Rodney in this food crate that they have, right? And then they start heading outside because he knew they had a time when the food truck was there because they have a local truck that delivers to all the different facilities. So they're going to get back on the truck and head on down the road, right? So they get through the first gate. They let them buzz through. No problem. They get to the second gate and the one officer goes, hey, make sure that you swipe your card to get out because that gives a record, as you know, of who's been in and out of the facility. He's like, oh, man, I forgot mine. And he was like, do I know you? And he's like, no, I'm new. You know, I haven't been here that long. He's like, what was your name again? Well, immediately he starts swinging and Breggett comes flying out of the bin and starts climbing up the gate trying to get out. I mean, they're in desperation mode at this point, right? Their plan is falling apart in front of them. Dude up on the balcony tags them both with rubber bullets and they both hit the ground. Like, I can't imagine what that's got to feel like to get hit with a rubber bullet. Like,
it can't be good.
No. I mean, but it worked for both of them. And so they got them both cuffed, put them back out, no problem. So once they realized what had happened there, they knew they had to go find Johnson, right? Because they were like, where did these guys come from? So they head to the area, they find him. He fought hard. I mean, through that, it took him about 30 minutes from the time that it happened until they actually found him. And he actually fought for about another hour before he passed away. 63rd birthday, man. I was like, oh, really?
Right there on the edge of retirement.
Right. You know, and doing the right thing, you know, working his extra shift. So immediately, both men plead guilty, and they're both given the death penalty instantaneously. And Robert actually told the court, after they gave him his sentence of death, he said, you have 1 year to kill me. And if you don't, I'm going to kill a guard. So South Dakota actually honored his wish, and at 11 months and 11 days, they executed him. So
wow,
less than a year.
Woo!
And they got
high
him
all, five.
They got him through. I was shocked when I read about that. I mean, I think the guy had a death wish. It's either I'm all out or I'm all in at this point with it. Well, Rodney begins his appeals process, and he blamed the entire thing on Rodney. You know, said that Rodney was the one that did the killing. It wasn't actually him, and it just didn't work. They got in there, and every time that they tried to bring that up, they were like, nah, you were definitely a huge part of it. Even as a co-conspirator, like, we have to do this. I was like, I don't know. Another one where, like, you don't know for sure. Did he actually do it? Right?
Yeah, but you can't run with people that are going to, we're going to kill this guy.
Right, you can't. But I think that if you're involved in the killing of an officer, that whether you did a single blow or not, I think that you're still on the hook for it.
Agreed.
Especially in a situation like this. This isn't something out in the streets where your buddy goes up and does something stupid, you know, to where you didn't have a choice to be involved for a minute till you get yourself out of it, you know? So nothing ever works. And it gets to 2017. So this isn't that long later. I mean, we're talking 6 years, right? Compared to what all these other ones are. He actually says, you know what? I'm going to drop all my appeals. I knew what I was doing, and I continue to do it anyway. He said, I destroyed a family. I took a father. I took a husband. I took a grandpa. He said, and by the way, I will not appear in court again. Consider everything dropped. And he held to his word. They tried to bring him in for a couple things, and he fought a tooth and nail. So they said, you know what? We'll just let you do it from prison. So they set a monitor up in front of him, and he just was like, meh. Wouldn't even pay attention, wouldn't engage in anything. And so they went ahead and they set his execution date for 2018. So here's a little bit of a comparison, just because I thought that it was a little bit interesting for the executions. So Rogers was in 1987, right? Roger has 2 bacon cheeseburgers, large order of onion rings, an extra large root beer, and a pint of chocolate ice cream, right? And that's before his death in 2000. Rodney, the younger brother, he has pancakes, waffles, maple syrup with butter, breakfast sausages, scrambled eggs, French fries, Pepsi, and a 3-pound bag of cherry nibs. You know what cherry nibs are? Like the little licorices?
Yeah.
I was like, how do you eat 3 pounds of licorice?
That's a lot.
I mean, that is a freaking ton, right? And he didn't ask to see anybody for the night before. He knew that he actually had some family that was coming in. Rodney did. Roger had nobody. Nobody from their family showed up to his execution, which I thought that was kind of crazy. I mean, somebody in that family still has to care, right?
You would think.
I mean, I don't know. I can't imagine going through that on that side of it, you know? If it's your family that did it, how would you feel about the whole thing? I don't know.
Well, I guess it depends on the crime, but if it's really, really bad, I mean, they might be just, they don't want to show their face.
Right.
You know?
I agree. So they get him strapped in. It takes a little bit of extra time because there's a few appeals, you know, but finally by 7:30, they got him in the chair. It's October the 29th of 2018. They get him in and he says goodbye, I love you, to 2 of his granddaughters. His daughter was there to where he was kind of giving the message to her. They didn't directly have the grandchildren there for that. And then he looked at the warden and he's like, sorry for the delay. I got caught in traffic, and kind of gave a little chuckle to where I thought that was a little bit strange. You know what I mean? Like I was supposed to be here earlier?
No. He's doing the Jake Kiba. He's bringing a little bit of comedy.
I mean, I guess. I mean, that's what they said. They say he cracked a joke. I'm like, I didn't get the joke, though. But it's kind of crazy. What's funny is that they both, not funny, but they both died from lethal injection, obviously. They both actually had the same 3-drug cocktail, which is interesting, I thought. And Roger, the older brother, he passed away in 14 minutes. And Rodney in 12 minutes.
Wow.
So all in all, that's the story of 2 brothers in 2 states that led 2 different but kind of similar lives of crime. And this makes these the Birgit brothers, and they're the only 2 direct relatives that have ever been executed for different crimes. There was one other set.
Completely isolated. Yeah.
There was one other set of brothers, but it was a multiple murder that they were both involved in right. The same night. This is 25 years apart that all this goes down.
Jeez.
Pretty crazy.
That's really crazy.
Yeah. And in places that they don't execute a lot of people.
Right.
So he's the last one actually from South Dakota. And they don't have a law change in place for it yet, but they're saying that it might not change. So he might be the last one to go.
Wow.
Rodney. So sad story, though. I mean, imagine having 2 of your kids executed. I mean, I know that the parents didn't really care, but I mean, even 2 of my siblings, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's almost unfathomable that a list that short, I mean, 1,500 people, even though we're getting towards like 1,650 at this point, that's still not that many people for how many people live in this country.
Right. So there was 4 other siblings. So yeah. Yeah. Oh, I had 2 other brothers. Oh, well, yeah. Well, they were both executed.
Yeah. It's hard to sell that.
Death penalties.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm going to keep on moving then.
Sure. So a couple questions to finish up. And I know that there's a bunch of cases and a lot of people and stuff involved with this show. So the one guy I want to go back to is Smith. So one of the two guys in the original carjacking in the shooting of Mr. Patterson, who was the school teacher, right?
Like 300 years. No, well, no, like
500 years and six life sentences.
Right. Well, what's the six life sentences? Like, are we saying 80 years, 85 years is an average? I mean, six times 85, that's a lot. Plus 500 years?
Yeah, man. It's over 1,000 years. 1,000 years of
prison.
Just
in case he lives forever?
There's no way. It's physically impossible. It's crazy. And to me, what I'm saying is, to me, this is one of those things where I'm surprised that somehow they didn't try him federally to get him an execution. I mean, this guy's got to go at some point.
You'd think the federal reprieve here with the executions may be like, let's look at this guy's file.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. It's crazy to me. So, do you think that Roger, the brother that was with Smith, do you think that he should have at least been offered life? I mean, I just felt like the evidence against him was so flimsy. I mean, it was a he said, she said is what it came down to. He said that he didn't shoot him. The other guy said that he shot him. The other guy had actually, I didn't have this in the show, but he had actually bragged to somebody else that he fired the first shot. I don't know. I have a hard time giving him execution for it.
It is a he said, she said, and to me, that sounds like bullshit.
Yeah. And what's weird is that he already had the death sentence when he gave up the other murder. So to me, it doesn't really, I mean, does the second murder make it guaranteed? Like, hey, man, you were involved twice, even if you weren't involved. I don't know. I feel like that's a really tough one that people could write long stories and opinions and stuff on. Kind of where if you're at two murders, you don't pull the trigger either time, are you eligible for a death sentence?
I think some of these cases could have been reopened and that Smith should have been given the death penalty.
Yeah.
And then the other guy, maybe, I guess if you want to give him life or I mean, I don't know. It's hard to say.
It is.
Maybe even 30 years. I mean, give that guy 30 years. But then he killed another one, though, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. He was involved with two, but they denied actually being the trigger man in either one.
Yeah, it's very tough.
Yeah. I don't know. To me, that's one of the harder questions we've had on it. There's not a clear-cut, easy answer for it.
No.
So just kind of a silly question, but how crazy that these two guys are brothers?
Very crazy.
I mean, like, we've all heard of, like, there was a group of brothers I knew in school that was, like, the brothers that nobody messed with. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. There were three brothers. They were all real tough. You know what I mean? To where, like, nobody was messing with those guys.
Yeah.
So I can kind of get that.
Yeah.
But this is a different level.
It's way different. You kind of almost expect them to get in trouble together, but they didn't.
Right. Well, they did when they were young.
Right.
But then they got themselves on different paths.
Right. It's weird.
I just, man, I struggle to wonder how Rodney goes down the same path, you know? It's terrible. Unfortunate the entire way around. But that's the story tonight of the Breggett brothers.
All right.
So before we go, I just want to make sure that I give you the public service announcement that if you or somebody else is suffering from mental health, please pick up the phone. Please make a call. If you're struggling with any kind of addiction, any kind of abuse, please go ahead and reach out. Somebody's going to be out there to help you.
Absolutely. So if you're having bad thoughts about hurting yourself or others, or you're chemically dependent, please give them a call.
Yep. So thank you guys so much for joining us. I hope you enjoyed tonight's Patreon episode. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Pip, pip.
Cheerio.